So here we go. We're going to get on with our show. So I have a guest on today, and let me tell you what, you're going to love this man. He's heartwarming. He's a great storyteller, and he's just plain lovely. He is the author of Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder, who was his father, and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. His name is Steve Snyder. Here you go. And what I know about this book is hold your breath, because there's active moments and activity, and you just have to hold your breath and your heart at the same time. So let's welcome you, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Marilyn. Nice to be on the show.
Well, it's nice to be here. And thank you for coming in all the way from California.
That's right. No pollen here.
No pollen ever?
No. Uh-uh.
Ever.
No pollen, no bugs, no snow. Can't beat the beach in Southern California.
You cannot. No pollen. Oh, my goodness. Goodness gracious. I don't think I've ever lived anywhere where it didn't turn green at some point. So tell us about you, Steve.
Okay. Well, I was born and raised in Southern California. I was born in Pasadena, home of the Rose Bowl. Went through the school system here, went to college at UCLA, where I was a classmate of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, better known as Lew Alcindor back then. And then I got into a career of sales and sales management. The last 36 years, I worked for a company called Vision Service Plan, VSP. It provides vision care as an employee benefit that corporations offer their employees to cover eye examinations, glasses, and contact lenses. During that 36 years, the last 25 of it, I traveled extensively. I was national or VP of national accounts, calling on Fortune 500 companies throughout the country. And in the last 15 years, even though I lived in Southern California, I was vice president of our Eastern Sales Division, which was everything east of the Mississippi. So I traveled quite a bit. I've been married to my current wife, Glenda, for it'll be 35 years this year. We have three grown sons. We also have a second home in Sedona, Arizona. So we go back and forth between Seal Beach, California, where I am now, which is about 40 miles south of LA, and then Northern Arizona, Sedona. People are not familiar with it. It's where all the red rocks are, a beautiful place. And so that's kind of my history. I retired from VSP in 2009, and that's when I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. I knew the basics growing up. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. And on February 8th of 1944, he was shot down over Belgium after a mission to Frankfurt, Germany. And he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England.
And how did he avoid being captured?
Oh, after his plane was shot down, his plane was shot down by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters. And two of the B-17 had a 10-man crew. Two of the crew were killed in the plane. The other eight were able to bail out successfully. And after my dad bailed out, he was hidden by Belgian people, members of the underground, for several months. After which he got tired of hiding, so he decided to join the French resistance and started sabotaging German convoys.
Wow.
And then finally, when Patton's Third Army came up through France after D-Day, he met up with them and got back to England.
Wow, your dad was something.
Yeah. I don't know whether I don't know how many other people could have, you know, left that relative safety. It really wasn't safe, because when he was being hidden, the German secret police, the Gestapo, could break in at any moment and arrest him. And he had some very close calls that are in the book about almost being found out by the Germans. But he left that relative safety of being hidden and waiting for the U.S. armies to come up and liberate the area. But he wanted to get back in the fight. And you know, he risked his life not only fighting against the Germans, but if the Germans had captured him, they would have shot him right on the spot. So that took a lot of courage and a lot of bravery to do that.
So I want to go more into the book, but tell me about your dad in general.
He was quite a guy. I have two older sisters, Susan Ruth, that was the plane was named after, and then my other sister Nancy was actually born while he was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mother at the time. There she was back in the U.S. in 1944 with a one-year-old baby girl and an infant baby, not knowing if she'd ever see her husband again. Now I lost my train of thought.
Well, you were telling me about your dad in general.
Oh, my dad, yeah. But my sisters and I, we always kind of compared him to John Wayne or James Arness, for the people that can remember the TV show Gunsmoke. Uh-huh. He was a big guy, kind of a no-nonsense guy, rugged guy, but a loving father. He and I were very close. He coached my little league team, was always very supportive in my of my endeavors and playing sports. Yeah, very hardworking guy, and like that generation, which I think is the greatest generation. You know, he had a very good hard work ethic, very strong moral fiber. He and my mother were strong Christians with a deep faith, believed in hard work. That generation were just unbelievable people.
Yes, they were. And so what did he used to talk about the war with you?
He talked a little bit about it. As I mentioned, I knew the basics, but like most World War II veterans, he didn't talk too much about it. It wasn't until 1989, this Belgium foundation called the Belgium American Foundation, formed by a Dr. Paul Delahaye that I'll talk about further. They erected a memorial to my dad and his crew in the little village of Mackinaws, Belgium, which is where the plane came down, just north of the French border. And my dad and the other three crew members that were still living at the time went over for the dedication. And there he was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war, saw these houses where he was hidden. And that brought it all back. And he started talking about it a lot after that. And then my first trip was to Europe, or to Belgium, I should say, and I had been over there five times, was in 1994. I went over to the 50th anniversary reunion with my parents, and that's when it became personal for me because I saw all those places where the events took place and was actually fortunate enough to meet a couple of his Belgium helpers. They're all gone now. So that was a very exciting time for me to share that with my parents and with my dad.
That must have been just amazing.
It was. They treated him like royalty. One time, they're amazing events. I'm actually going over for the sixth time this fall for the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. My dad's plane being shot down, and they last several days. They erect these huge tents, and hundreds of people come to these events. All the local villagers, all the dignitaries, the U.S. military comes down, Belgian military, French military. They have these band concerts and lunches and dinners. And one time we got to this big tent a little late. This was in 1994. And when we walked in, when my dad walked in, everyone in this tent stood up and started applauding. I get chills just talking about it. The Belgian people are wonderful people. To this day, they're still so thankful and so grateful for the Americans coming to rescue them and free them and liberate them from Nazi oppression. And they just wonder, well, people, they couldn't have treated the president of the United States any better than the way they treated my dad when he was over there. It was a very moving experience.
You become family.
Absolutely. I've made some lifelong, deep, wonderful friendships with people in Belgium. I look forward to seeing them again in a few months.
That says a lot about them and your dad, that they could experience that and feel that gratitude and appreciation and realize what happened.
Yes.
Yeah. That's great. So tell me why your dad, why was a tribute to him?
Well, you mean the book or the?
No, no, you said that they had a, yes.
Well, the memorial is to the entire crew, not just my dad. And likewise, the book is just not about my dad, but it's really about what happened to each member of the crew, because something different happened to each guy. Five of the crew made it back home, but five of them did not. And it's all also about the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help my dad and his crew. And they were unbelievably brave people to do that. If the Gestapo found out that they were aiding down airmen, they would be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to concentration camps. And some of the Belgian people that helped my dad and his crew met that fate, and it's talked about in the book. Unbelievably brave people. But as I mentioned, they were just to go through what they went through of 4 years, the 1940 to 1944 of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. They were just so grateful for being liberated and being free again and enjoying the freedoms that they lacked when the Nazis were occupying their country. So they just have a deep respect and want to honor and remember those Allied servicemen that came to free their country.
Well, you know, it's like the Holocaust, and Amnon has a Vietnam show on, right? If we talk about it, we won't forget.
Now, in fact, my little motto or tagline is, it's our duty to remember.
Exactly.
Which we must always do.
Right. And I have a tagline sometimes I share, it's our duty to listen.
Oh,
you know, I mean, it is. It's our duty to pay attention to these things.
Absolutely.
And share the stories.
Absolutely.
So what was it about this that you wanted to know more about?
Well, after I retired, my parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and find out more detail. At that time, in 2009, after I retired, I had no intention of writing a book whatsoever. And there were two items that were really significant that my parents had kept. One was a diary that my dad had written while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. And it is absolutely riveting, and it's in the book. My dad was actually a pretty good writer. And the other item were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England during the war. And he was very candid in those letters. He talked about what, you know, he talked about his love for my mother and their devotion to each other. But he also talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the base, his air base, the 306 bomb group at Thurlow, England, what life was like in England and London at the time, what escapades of his crew, himself and his crew, and reading those letters, absolutely fascinating. And I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe. I went on the internet and just spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all his crew members to see if they had any information they could give to me. And I found relatives of all of his crew. And I asked them if they had any pictures or newspaper articles or letters that they could send to me to give me more details. I joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my efforts or my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that it needed to be told. People needed to read about it. And so I decided to write a book.
So on some level, I'm hearing you and I'm thinking, the kind of research that you did, besides researching the other members of his crew, was kind of validation for you, I would say, on some level, about the stories and, you know, what your dad went through and all of that.
Yeah. When I first started, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to start writing about it. I thought, well, it's going to be about my dad. And I quickly found out it's not just about my dad, but it's about all the members of his crew. And then it was about all the Belgian people. And it's really not just about my dad's crew, but it's about all the men who fought in the 8th Air Force during World War II. There were 26,000 men died serving in the 8th Air Force during the air war and the bombing campaign over Europe. That's more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific during the war. Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force during World War II was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during the war. What those men went through was unbelievable. Every day they went up on a mission, they might never return. It's an amazing story about the air war over Europe and the 8th Air Force. And really the book is kind of two books into one. It's the story of my dad and his crew and what happened, but it's also a history of the 8th Air Force in the air war over Europe. The story itself is all based on firsthand testimony by the people who were involved in the events that took place. What I added was just a great deal of historical information and anecdotes about and surrounding the war to put it into context and give it background.
So you wrote the book when?
The book was released in August of 2014. So we're coming on, I can't believe it, almost 5 years since the book was released. Uh-huh. And it's done well. It has a 5-star rating on Amazon, and it's won close to 30 book awards.
Wow.
Released. And there's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything that you're reading about. And there's lots of excerpts from letters from my dad, my mother, other members of the crew, and family members to make it real personal as well.
What a labor of love, Steve.
Yes, it was. It still is, actually. Since I wrote the book, it's changed my life.
In what way?
Well, after I retired, you know, I was a typical retiree. I was sleeping in late, taking naps, going for walks, you know, reading books. And now I'm basically working full time again. I go to air shows all over the United States signing copies of my book. I do a lot of speaking. I make PowerPoint presentations to all sorts of different organizations around the country. I spend hours every day on the internet promoting the book and contacting people. So really, it's a full-time job. And I love what I do. I meet all sorts of wonderful people at these events I go to. I meet lots of veterans and get to know them and learn their stories. So it's very, very rewarding.
Yeah, I haven't done that. You know, I haven't sat with vets and listened to their stories. And you know, listening to you now, it's kind of like, I really should, because they are our heroes.
Absolutely. There were 16 million veterans at the end of World War II. And there's less than 4% of those men that are still with us, and we're losing them at a rapid pace. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the world and the United States forever. So the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are the greatest generation, and their sacrifice must never be forgotten.
Right.
And it's really, I'm immediate past president of the 306 bomb group, which my dad was in. I'm still on the board. And it's the mission of the organization, and really the mission of my presentations as well, to remember, honor, and educate. Remember the air war over Europe, the honor of the men that fought it, and to educate the public about it, especially younger generations, because World War II happened over 70 years ago, and it's fading in people's memory, and we cannot let that happen. We have to remind them of what these men fought for and to enjoy the freedoms that we enjoy today.
Absolutely. So take us back into some about your dad's diary. Like, what were some of the things that you learned, like what he did every day? And just tell us about some of the things, the experiences that you read in his diary.
Okay. Well, his experiences are more so in his letters.
Okay.
Because the diary was just about kind of that day, you know, going on the mission and then being attacked by the German fighters and the planes on fire. And I mean, it's, as I said, it's just riveting. But it's interesting that the night before, he and his, like, as I mentioned, a B-17 had a 10-man crew. There were four officers. My dad was the pilot, the first pilot. And as such, he was the commander of the plane and the crew. And as a result, he had the final say in what the plane was named. Only three of the 10-man crew were married at the time. My dad was the only one that had a child. I think that's why they kind of boiled it down to naming the plane after my oldest sister. But the night before the mission, my dad and the other three officers went out to a little pub called the Falcon, which is near the base, which is still there today. In fact, I've gone there when I've been in the UK. I'm going over there again, and I had a couple pints at that bar. But they tied one on, and they got drunk the night before the mission. But they were able to sober up pretty quick, because those B-17s or those bombers of World War II, they weren't pressurized. So above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or else they'd pass out in a few minutes and they could die. But breathing that pure oxygen, you know, sobered them up real quick. So they were feeling okay after that. And he thought it was just going to be like another mission, you know, a bombing mission. He had kind of overcome his fear about going on missions, although when he got to the bomb run, they were still pretty nerve-wracking. Getting those planes weren't pressurized, so it was extremely cold at the altitude that they were flying. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero, so frostbite was a huge problem on these missions, and a lot of airmen suffered serious frostbite injuries that put him in the hospital for months. But when he was on the bomb run, even though it was so cold up there, he would be sweating profusely from the adrenaline running through his body. He said he'd just be dripping wet with sweat. Because not only did they have the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, to contend with, all these German fighters coming to attack him, trying to shoot him down, but they also had to face anti-aircraft fire. These German flak guns — flak was a abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon — and they were deadly weapons. They fired shells, about 20 shells per minute, and these shells were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bombers were flying, and these shells were filled with all different shapes and sizes of razor sharp metal that would explode out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. If a bomber was hit directly by one of these flak shells, they just explode and basically disintegrate and disappear. Or if it knocked a wing off, these bombers would just plummet to the earth. So these bombing missions were, harrowing experiences. And the plane had dropped their bomb successfully, but the bomb bay doors got hit by flak, and they couldn't get the bomb bay doors back up, and that caused a drag on the plane, and they started losing airspeed and started lagging behind the formation, and they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters, who, like wolves or lions coming to attack prey, swooped in for the kill. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. However, both those German fighter planes were shot down as well. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and it crashed, and he was killed in the plane. And the other was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out, and he made it through the war. Actually, the gunners on my dad's plane shot down Hans Berger's plane, so they really shot each other down. During my research, it's kind of a funny story. One day my wife just casually mentioned, "Well, why don't you try to find a German pilot that shot down your dad's plane?" Like, it's as easy as going to the grocery store and getting a loaf of bread. You know, and I'm thinking, well, she doesn't have any idea what she's talking about. You know, she's crazy, stupid idea. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And lo and behold, I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, became a translator after the war. So he speaks perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it's like to go up against the 8th Air Force. Hans is 95 years old today, still living in Munich, Germany, and we've become friends.
So let me ask you something, because this is a good place for me to ask you this question. So, I mean, he, you know, was shooting at your dad. What was his feelings about what he did?
Well, he was really pretty much just like the U.S. airman. He was, you know, just a young guy, 20 years old at the time, fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. He told me that it was unfortunate that they had to be shooting at each other, but, you know, that's what they were assigned to do. And, you know, unfortunately, the two countries were at war with each other. And, that's just life.
And did he remember this situation, this experience? Did he remember shooting at this plane and that experience?
Yeah, he doesn't remember a lot of the details. He remembers attacking my dad's plane. You know, he had no idea whose plane it was, and that his plane got hit and he had to bail out. And when he was coming down in his parachute, he could see some of the men, the crew from my dad's plane coming down their parachutes, you know, a couple miles away. He came down in Belgium and it was occupied by the Germans. So they picked him up and then he got back to his base and continued flying.
And what was it like for you to actually sit with this man?
Well, for the book, I just interviewed him over the telephone and through email. But I did, in 2016, I went to visit him, to Munich. We filmed an interview, with him. I hope to make a documentary about the book, first of all, finding him was so exciting. My dad just knew that he was shot down by two German fighters. And, you know, it never dawned on me that I would find the guy that shot down my dad's plane. So it gives me goosebumps just talking about it. But I was so excited to talk to him. But when we met in person, you know, face to face, that was an amazing experience. We first went to lunch right across the street at this little German restaurant. We had some Wiener Schnitzel and had a couple of Augustiner beers together. And then went back to his apartment to film the interview. I was with my youngest son, who's in the kind of the business, and then with a cameraman, and we kind of rearranged his apartment. He was wondering what's going on. We're moving furniture and stuff, and he thought we were just going to talk, and all of a sudden we set up two cameras, you know, and he's starting to get nervous, you know? And we start the interview. But that was very, very exciting. He brought out his logbook and showed his entry on February 8th of 1944, where he shot down a B-17 and he had to bail out of his plane. You know, I took pictures of that. And so we had a nice chat. He was actually shot down three times and still made it through the war.
It's an extraordinary, extraordinary encounter.
Yeah.
I mean, here you are meeting the man who could have killed your dad.
Yeah. When I get asked now and then, well, don't you hate this guy? He shot down your dad's plane. And I feel kind of a personal relationship, kinship with him. You know, one specific moment in time in history, his path or his life and my dad's life crossed paths. And, you know, for all these guys that fought in World War II, that was the defining moment in their lives. I mean, nothing matched what they went through during the war, and it was for my dad. So it was a part of my dad's story, and Hans Berger's part of my dad's story, part of his life. So I felt a kinship with him, and I plan on going back to see Hans in September, because he's 95, and you know, I don't know how much longer he's going to be around or when I'm going to be able to get back to Germany. So I want to go visit him again.
Well, I think it's an extraordinary experience, and I can understand how you would not, how you could handle it the way you did. It's almost like he knew you. It's I know it sounds bizarre, but he knew you in some indirect manner. He knew your dad in some, in, you know, he was a connection. It's yeah. crazy. And I can understand how you could even love this man, you know, yeah. for how, what he accomplished or, you know, whatever. I mean, it's amazing to me, but it's the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. When we were sitting there, he goes, you know, this is pretty amazing that here I am sitting with, you know, being friends with the son of a B-17 pilot that I shot down during World War II. But it's a great thing, and it's a, you know, wonderful thing that, you know, we can be friends.
Yes, it's the wonder of the human.
Yeah.
Okay, so what other stories do you have like that one? I know you got to have a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just
give well, me a, give well, us one, another one.
One thing I have to mention is I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen.
Okay.
One who I mentioned earlier, Dr. Paul Delahaye, and the other, Jacques Allot. And they were young boys during the war and greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed against their friends and family. And later in life, they became local historians. And they interviewed Belgian people, members of the Belgium underground, about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information that's in the book about events that would have been lost forever without their research. So I owe them a huge debt of gratitude for their dedicated efforts in recording this information. And they gave me, as well as a lot of the Belgian people that helped my dad, gave my dad and gave me lots of pictures that were taken by Belgian people in 1944 that are in the book. So amazing pictures that were taken, you know, 70 years ago. So
you were that, kind of at the right place at the right time in doing this.
I am so fortunate. Most people know very little about their World War II veteran, whether it's a son or daughter or a cousin or, you know, a nephew. But I just so blessed to have so much information about what happened to my dad during the war and then after he was shot down. Yeah, just an incredible pictures. Dr. Paul Delahaye, he formed in the mid 80s at the Belgium American Foundation to remember and honor these airmen. As I mentioned, they not only built that memorial to my dad and his crew, but they built a number of other memorials. He died in 2013 at the age, I think, of 82. But his daughter, actually, he has two daughters and a son, but one of his daughters, are Crystal and Severine Delahaye and Jacques Delahaye, his son. They continue his legacy, and the name of the organization is now, in English, the Duty to Remember Association. That's where I kind of got that tagline. Mm-hmm. And they have, on the anniversary of events every year, it was for my dad and his crew, February 8th, they have ceremonies at these memorials to remember and honor. And then they put on these big ceremonies in September because the liberation of Belgium.
Steve,
is
awesome. Are they using your book in school? In the schools there, in like high school?
No, I, unfortunately, my book has not been translated into French. A lot of people don't realize that Belgium's a unique little country. The northern half of it, that's called Flanders, where they speak Dutch, but the southern half of it, where my dad's plane came down, is called Wallonia, where they speak French. And the northern half's pretty industrial, and the southern half is all rural farmland. So things really haven't changed in southern Belgium in hundreds of years. So all these places are still there during the war. And it's just to go for me and or my sons to go inside these farmhouses or homes where my dad was hidden and actually see the room where he stayed in is just fantastic.
It is fantastic. You know, because I was mentioning to Steve, and I'm sure many of you have stories similar to mine. My dad was in World War II, and I was telling Steve, he did not fight. He wasn't in combat because his shoes were too big. He wore a 13D and they didn't have shoes big enough. So he was like in the mess hall and things like that. But the few times that he said something, which was not much, when he was in Africa or he was here, he mentioned climbing over bodies. That was the one thing that I remember him saying. And unfortunately, I didn't ask him enough.
You know? Yes, when we're young, we're interested in, you know, when we're kids, they're our own thing. And then we get jobs and go to college and have families. And, you know, you don't ask those questions until you get a little smarter and older. But then a lot of these vets are gone by that time.
Yes,
I hear this story again and again and again by people that, you know, gosh, I don't know anything about my vet. I should have asked him these questions. He didn't talk about it at all. One of the things that is rewarding for me when people read the book, especially if their vet was in the 8th Air Force, is they say, well, now I have a better understanding after reading Shot Down. I have a better understanding of what my vet went through as far as, you know, bombing missions over Europe. So that's a nice feeling to know that it helps
very
them
much
gain information
very much. And that's why you know, and when is your Vietnam show on?
Wednesday
what time?
Eight.
So Amnon has a show on this channel 8 o'clock on Wednesday nights, all about Vietnam. And I think, you know, we're talking about this kind of thing now. I think it's really relevant, you know, for those of you out there that are interested and just tune in. I mean, it's live. You'll hear stories, right? Mm-hmm. And first account and stories. And, you know, this is how history is going, you know, that kind of history is going to go away. So yeah, it's important that we listen. And so one more thing I want to mention, everyone, please feel free. If you've got a question, you have a story, you have a comment, anything, call us now, 919-518-9773, or computers, that's plural, then the number 2K voice, that will be on Skype. And then you can more than welcome into our chat and you can ask questions and comment from there as well. So Steve, continue.
Okay.
Tell us more stories.
I mentioned, you know, the plane, my dad bailed out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that my dad and the plane actually came down in Belgium, but the other men that were able to bail out came down in France. So they were shot right over the French-Belgian border. And my dad came down, his parachute got hung up in these trees and he couldn't get down. He was dangling 20 feet off the ground. But fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men, Raymond Durvan and Henri Franken, came to his rescue before the Germans got to him. They went back to this farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped him down out of the trees. And this took place around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They told him to stay put and hide because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during daylight, with German patrols combing the area looking for these guys that had bailed out. So that night they came back and got him and they took him to the farmhouse of Raymond Durvan and his parents, Edmund and Ida Durvan. And he stayed there one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with those German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle and take him to another location. It was pitch black, middle of the night, raining, and off they start on the tandem bicycle. But my dad could only pedal with one leg because the other had got hit by shrapnel from these anti-aircraft shells going off and the 20 millimeter cannon shells fired from these German fighters. So they came to a hill and they weren't able to pedal up it anymore. So they started pushing the bike up the hill. And when they came to the top of the hill, there was a cafe, a cabaret there, and the lights were on, music was playing, there's loud talking, laughter. And all of a sudden, two German officers come out with their arms around these young girls. And one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around my dad's shoulder and asks him for a light for a cigarette. But my dad couldn't speak German or French at that time, but fortunately, Paul was able to and lit the guy's cigarette. They let him go on their way.
Hold on one second. What is your father? He must have changed his clothing.
Very good point. Paul, this was just a funny story too, because Paul, he was a customs officer. They had these little pillbox hats and a cape. And he brought one of his uniforms for my dad to put on. But Paul's wife, Nellie, who I was able to meet actually, later when she saw my dad, was laughing because Paul was a rather short man. My dad was tall. He was 6'3". And so the pants on my dad, you know, were way too short. But I guess in the dark and on the bicycle, they these guys, that the Germans really didn't notice that. Also, my dad said these Germans were so drunk and, you know, interested in these young girls that they really didn't pay too much attention to my dad and Paul, who were pushing this bike up the range. But my dad said they were very friendly. You know, they were jabbering away. You know, again, you're drunk. I guess, fortunately, they were happy drunks and not mean drunks, I guess.
I guess, and you know, Steve, it's what just crossed my mind. If it wasn't for all of these people, you wouldn't be here.
No, because I was born after the war in 1947. It's interesting, and the people who read the book and these in excerpts, some letters that's in the book, my dad always referred to the baby that was born while he was missing in action as Steve or Stevie, but he turned out to be Nancy. Yeah, I came back, he came along after the war. As my mother said, it was the best mistake they ever made.
Isn't that interesting? So he was calling your sister Stevie and didn't even know it was a girl yet.
No, he had no idea if it was a girl or boy until he got back to England. And then found out that my mother had had the baby and it was a little baby girl, Nancy.
Wow. So really and truly, that's incredible. I mean, when you meet these people, this wife, this person, I mean, these people are instrumental in the fact that you were born.
Yeah, they saved my dad's life. As I said, they were unbelievably brave people. My dad said that after Paul picked him up and took him away from the Durvan house, after that, he was moved from place to place to place. He might spend one night at a house. He might spend 6 weeks at a house. It all depended on how brave the people were that lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. Mm-hmm. He was moved around from place to place. But my dad said that the people would let them sleep in their bed. They'd sleep on the floor. They'd give him the majority of the food because everything was rationed back then. So there was a shortage of food. My dad said if you stay with someone that had a little money, you know, they could buy some extra food on the black market. But if they were poor, you know, then they're eating potatoes or bread made out of sawdust and things like that.
So I'm making the assumption, correct me if I'm wrong, that your dad was the last one in the plane since he was the pilot.
Correct. Yeah.
And yes. So the other crew members that died, were they part of the five, or I think you said five, that bailed out in France, or who were they?
Two were killed in the plane, and then three of the crewmen died a couple months later
On the ground. In France?
Actually, in Belgium.
In Belgium.
Yeah, in Belgium. They came down in France, but then they came over to Belgium. But to find out all the details to the other members of the crew, you need to read the book.
Yes, that's the point. That's the point. So let me hold up the book again and then just tell everybody, we're not done yet. We have more to talk about, but just tell everybody where they can find your book.
Sure. Well, most people get it on Amazon. It's available as a hardcover, softcover, every ebook format. It's available as an audio book, although you don't have any pictures in the audio book. And the ebook, there's only 24 pictures as opposed to the print book that has well over 200. Mm-hmm. So Amazon, if someone wants an autographed book, they can go on my website on the homepage. My website is Steve Snyder, Snyder, author.com. And you can order an autographed copy on my website. But any library can order if they don't have it in the library, and any bookstore, if they don't have it in stock, they can order it from their wholesale book distributor, you know, Barnes and Noble or what have you. But over 50% of the books that are purchased today are bought on Amazon.
Amazon, right.
Amazon is, as most people don't realize this, but Amazon, they change the price of the book every single day. The retail price of the book is 27, the hardcover book is $27.95. But they change the price of the book every day. They might sell it for the retail price. They might sell it for $19.56. It changes every day. I don't know what their algorithm is.
I don't understand. How is that possible?
I don't know. It's weird.
Are you referring to them selling a used copy?
No.
Because I can't imagine them changing your retail price.
Well, the way that works for authors is they pay the author 45% of the retail price, regardless of what they sell the book for. So they might discount it, but the author still gets 45% of the retail price.
Well, I have a couple of books on Amazon. I haven't seen them change my price.
Oh yeah, it's funny. And then they'll say there's only two left in stock, or
right. They said that
stock,
I've seen.
There's nine, and you know, they just make all that up.
yeah, that I've seen, but changing my retail price, I haven't seen them do that yet. I'll have to look into that and try to understand that, because I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, sometimes at the full price, and sometimes it's like, you know, discounted 25, 30% or 11%. It changes all the time. I have no idea.
Interesting. You know, I'll have to look into that. So is there a next for you?
Well, I get asked a lot if I'm going to write another book, but right now I'm concentrating not only just on promoting the book, but hoping to make that documentary. That I'm working with my youngest son, Clayton, who is a film studies major at Pepperdine University. And he's also an actor. He was a child actor in middle school. Then he became a water polo player and played professionally. And now he's trying to get back into acting. And so he's working with a filmmaker and an editor. He's kind of the technical side of it. And we have hours and hours of footage that we filmed in Belgium and in Germany to try to, you know, put together to make a documentary. But it's a lot of work, and it also costs a lot of money.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. On all levels. And so is there a particular area you want to focus in on for the documentary, or is it going to reflect the book?
Well, you know, we're still kind of working that through, because you can talk about the story, but it's also pretty interesting, you know, how the book came about and how I researched all this and discovered the pilot and these houses and kind of the story behind of making the book or writing the book. So that it's to be determined. I'm not sure. We would love to have a rough cut that we could take to Belgium with us for the 75th anniversary in September. Whether we're able to meet that timetable or time frame, I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll have to see.
Well, I do think that it's a great idea to do a documentary if you can.
Yeah, because you can actually show these places in the documentary. You know, the houses, because there's a. Also in the book, there's a number of instances that I referred to that my dad was almost found out by the Gestapo. For example, there's one instance in the book, he was staying at a house with some of the people that he stayed with for lengthy periods of time. He became close friends with and stayed in contact with after the war, and they'd exchange letters, Christmas cards, and they provided my dad with lots of pictures. But there's a one house in Charleroi, Belgium, where it was hidden, and one day there was a loud pounding on the door, and the man who lived there, Maurice Bayou, came and answered the door. It was the Gestapo, so he told my dad to climb up on the roof and stay there until he came and got him. And well, this roof, it's really pitched and it's all tile, and he had to crawl out this little tiny window in the roof. It ended up, my dad stayed up there all night. Maurice never came and got him, I guess because he thought it was too dangerous. And I can't imagine being on this, you know, steeply slanted slate roof all night long in the cold. So there's a number of instances in the book that are described where he was almost the discovery. But to be in that room, to look through that little window, it was scary enough just to crawl up in the roof. To see those places where the, you know, history actually took place is fascinating.
Well, this whole thing is fascinating. To think that your father, you know, to be able to have almost a daily account of what he went through, there is no question. How do you live like that for a few days, seven months, and others have to live like that for years? You know, if you think of Anne Frank, I mean, it makes my skin curl.
Yeah, it was very stressful because, you know, first of all, my dad's plane's attacked, you know, it's on fire, it's going down, they all have to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military, and all of a sudden he's being helped by these people that are total strangers. Mm-hmm. Initially, he can't speak the language. He has a little French-English dictionary he can refer to, but they can't communicate. Any one of these people might be a collaborator with the Gestapo and turn him in. So it was very stressful. I think that's one of the reasons he got tired of hiding and wanted to get back in the fight. Another reason was that before he went into the Air Force, he was actually in the Army in the infantry for a year up in Washington. State of Washington. So he had a year's worth of infantry training and he knew how to fight on the ground, unlike most airmen that just went into the Air Force. He knew what to do. And word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy. So he knew that the Allies were on in Europe, had landed in Europe. And so he wanted to get back in the fight. And his people that were hiding him at the time thought it was way too dangerous for him to hook up with the French resistance. They were called the Mackie. And the French resistance, or the Mackie, was made up of small ragtag guerrilla groups spread throughout France. And they harassed the Germans. They would sabotage communications, attack railway lines or convoys, assassinate German officers. And they received their instructions over the BBC. The British Broadcasting Corporation, through coded messages, and they were supplied through airdrops by the British. And so he said, well, I'm just going to walk, you know, from Belgium and walk across the border and into France and try to hook up with the French resistance. I go, no, you can't do that. You'll be caught by the Germans for sure. So one of his helpers, Amy Cools, they went on bicycles across the border and she hooked him up with the resistance group. There were about 20 in the group that he joined up, led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a prisoner of war camp. But here he hooks up with this group of 20 people that are total strangers. He's a total foreigner. You know, they all spoke French, either they were Belgians or Frenchmen or Algerians, and they don't know him from Adam. He could be some plant or German spy, you know, that amazing that he decided to do that and then started sabotaging German convoys. And there's a number of instances in the book that described about encounters that they had with the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I guess that must have been just as horrifying, if not even sometimes more horrifying, what he had to do in those days.
He said the information they got from the British was unbelievably accurate as a result of the British breaking the Enigma code of the Germans.
Steve, you're a good researcher to be able. Oh my God! I mean, I've heard some people. I've heard a lot of people, you know, researching for books, researching the book about the book, you know, all that stuff. But you really, for somebody who was brand spanking new at this.
Well, for people who read the book, there's an unbelievable amount of detail in the book. When I was writing the book, sometimes I would think to myself, people are going to read this and think, oh, wait a minute here. All this happened over 70 years ago. How does this guy know?
Yeah, how did you do it? Yeah. Just Googling it?
Well, the old Dr. Paul Delahaye and Jacques Lalonde gave me that, you know, firsthand testimony by those Belgian people that were involved. There's the War Department had a real lengthy war crimes report that they interviewed Belgian people, Germans. As I mentioned, I had so much information, all the stuff my dad had and other members of the crew that survived. Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting. So hold on just a second. Just, you know, we have only just a few more minutes. So if anybody has a question, comment, story, strategy about any of this, please call in. We'd love to hear something about your life, your grandfather, your father, your brother, whoever it is. 919-518-9773 and Computers 2K Voice on Skype. And then also you still have time to come into our chat and join us there. And while Steve is doing what he's doing, I want to remind everyone to please feel free to watch tomorrow's show, the Health In show, about homeopathy tomorrow at 10 a.m. We have guests on the show tomorrow, and we're going to be talking about homeoprophylaxis. And that should be very, very interesting tomorrow at 10 a.m. Everybody tune in the first Tuesday in the month, right? It's the first Tuesday in the month, second Tuesday in the month to the Health In show, when we will be talking about all kinds of health issues and homeopathy. And we're going to, next month, I think we're talking about gastro issues and goes on and on and on and on from there. So please tune in. All right, Steve, did you find what you were looking for, Steve?
Well, I was looking for one picture in the book that is pretty incredible, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
Describe it to our audience so that when they go buy the book, they'll know what to look for.
Well, it's a story of my dad actually fighting with the French resistance, and like who took the picture and how it ever got back to my father is just a total mystery.
I but think when there's a will, there's a way. When these books are supposed to be written.
I don't know if you can.
No, we can't. What page is it on?
Oh, it's 285.
Okay. So for all of you out there, go buy Steve's book and turn to page 285.
Yeah, you can. That's my dad writing with Amy Cools, the one that took him across the border into France. And then the other picture is there's the farmhouse where my dad and the Mackey group stayed for a while.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's all still there today.
It's all still there. Amazing. Yeah. Okay, hold on one second. You have Amnon, you have my... Okay, so just for all of you out there, my books are on Amazon as well. I have two there now in just one afternoon, Listening to the Hearts of Men, stories about lovely men and their lives. And then in just one afternoon, Listening to the Hearts of Twins, incredible stories about relationship, sibling rivalry, parenting, just relationships that twins have are like just incredible. And we get to learn a lot about that. Next one up should be there in the next week or two in just one afternoon, Listening to the Hearts of Millennials. And next week, I will reveal the fourth book in the series, which is in just one afternoon, Listening into the Hearts of People Impacted by Opioid Addiction. I will show you that cover next week. So you'll have to tune in. It's a very cool cover. Okay, so Steve, in closing, what would you like to leave us with? What would you like to tell us?
Just to emphasize what these men went through to preserve freedom for the world. A lot of people don't realize that at the beginning years of the war, the outcome was very much in doubt. The Axis powers, Japan, Germany, they were winning the war. And it was very tenuous. So
freedom.
The freedom we enjoyed and what those guys did and the whole country did to preserve that freedom for us today is just can never be forgotten.
So let's take it like, so let's not forget that. Let's forget what an amazing opportunity this has been to experience the freedom we have in the United States for the most part, to walk the streets and do what we want to do and take it into yourselves and the freedom that you have to be able to do the things that you personally want to do and never forget these experiences that men like my father, like Steve's dad, and many of you out there, father, grandfather, brothers, and so forth, endured. So I want to thank you, Steve, for being here today. It's been amazing. I love all the stories and you're terrific. You're a terrific interview.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be on your show. You're delightful as well.
Thanks. Thank you so much. And as you progress and you have more stories to tell, you want to share some things, find us, okay?
Will do.
Come back. Thank you so much. And everyone out there, thanks so much for being here today. And Amnon, as always, thank you. And we will see you next week. Bye.
You are tuned to the Nissan Communications Network. If you tuned in too late, you can always watch each program in its entirety or download an MP3 audio file of it in the archives section at nissancommunications.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow us on Twitter, and like us on Facebook. Sponsored by Telestream's Wirecast Software, StreamingGear.com, Carolina Apparel, and DeltaForce.net.